Well, it has been 3 weeks since we have looked at the letter of James, and so I want to just take a brief moment and remind you of some of the things that are happening in the lives of the recipients of this letter and how it is that James is pastoring them. James is writing to his dear friends who used to be part of the church in Jerusalem. They are people that he knows, people that he dearly loves. But now they are, as he describes in the opening, scattered among the nations. And this has happened as a result of the persecution by the Jews that broke out on the day that Stephen was martyred. Naturally, they are disoriented. They are dismayed. They are confused. They are disheartened. Their minds are full of questions as they're trying to make sense out of their circumstances in light of the fact that they are facing trials of many kinds. So this is the backdrop into which James pens these words. Now you may recall that I informed you that James was influenced by the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. That's those books from Job to Song of Songs. So he was aware of the fact that life does not always follow predictable patterns that line up with our human reasoning and understanding. For example, the book of Job records the story of a man named Job, and he is described this way. He was blameless and upright. He feared God and he shunned evil. And yet, we read that he encountered trials of many kinds on a scale that would make you gasp at such unthinkable horror. James also watched as his half-brother Jesus, who was blameless and upright, feared God and shunned evil to a degree that surpassed Job. He watched as he was rejected, falsely accused, mocked, scorned, beaten, and crucified because he sought to lead people back to peace with God. And I have no doubt that James was wrestling with reconciling his own personal experiences of facing trials and persecution. Now, when life T-bones you or goes completely sideways, it has a tendency to rattle your brain and make you want to shake your fist at God. Perhaps you start to blame God. That's what James's friends were doing in the last passage we looked at 3 weeks ago. They were accusing God of tempting them. Now, if you would like to know how James addressed that subject, I encourage you to go to our website, go to our YouTube channel, and you can see how that was all addressed. I'm not going to go through that again today. In the verses we'll be looking at today, chapter 1, verses 16 through 18, James addresses a related issue that was apparently beginning to surface among his dear friends. And although it is not stated this way in our text, I'm going to present it in the form of a question. Now, it may be one that you have thought to yourself, or maybe you've even asked it out loud, and then you ducked for cover real quick. I know it's a question I've wondered about. It's a question that I have asked when I have found myself in the midst of trials or circumstances that just didn't make sense to me and certainly weren't fair or deserved. Here's the question. Is God really good? I mean, is God really good? Actually good? Now, you may never hear me make this offer again, this kind of an offer, but I'm going to do it today. And that is, if you're sitting here today, you have never, ever wrestled with that question, then you have permission to just quietly excuse yourself, go grab an early lunch, come back next week, and maybe I'll have something to say that speaks to you, that'll help you on your way to know Jesus better. But if you're like me, and you've wrestled with this question, or maybe as you sit here this morning, you're wrestling with this question, then I want you to stick around. I want you to listen as James lovingly reminds us of a truth that can help us to settle this issue once and for all in our hearts and minds. Now, this is not going to be a full-blown treatment of the subject of the problem of pain and evil and suffering, okay? We're not going to try and settle that this morning. We're just going to look at one scriptural perspective on this subject. So please listen as I read James chapter 1, verses 16 through 18. James writes, "Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created." There are three points that I'd like to draw to your attention from these verses. Point number one is that we must guard against being deceived. We must guard against being deceived. James's concern about his friends being deceived occurs a number of times throughout this letter. The exact word is used again, that is used here in verse 16, is also used again in chapter 5, verse 19, but it's translated differently there. It means to wander or to go astray when it's used in the active voice, or to be led astray or to be deceived when it is used in the passive or middle voice, like it is in our text right here. James also uses another word for deceive in his letter in chapter 1, just a few verses here in verse 22, and we'll be looking at that very soon. So this was obviously a matter of grave concern for him, and it was weighing heavy on his heart. You can probably see that James is not giving them a suggestion or a light warning. He's not saying to them, you may want to be careful and try to avoid being deceived. No, he is commanding them. This is a command to not be deceived. First half of verse 16 is just two words. In the original language, it is a negative adverb followed by a present passive or middle imperative verb. And so it is properly translated as it is here, don't be deceived. It's a command, don't be deceived. James's command begs the question, who is doing the deceiving? I suppose it's possible that James could have in mind some itinerant teachers masquerading as gospel preachers who were advocating false teaching and could potentially deceive their dear friends. We know that from other New Testament letters, this kind of assault against the church and the clear teachings of the gospel was occurring in other congregations. So it is a possibility. However, I tend to read this and believe that James is commanding his friends to be on guard against deceiving themselves. Against deceiving themselves. Remember that he's been talking, the larger issue in which we find this is trials of many kinds that they are facing. And in my experience, I find that one of my knee-jerk reactions to trials is to want to ask questions. And to oftentimes those questions get directed toward God or they're about God. The 19th century preacher John Adams gives an excellent comment and a word of warning with regard to guarding against deceiving ourselves in response to trials. Listen to what he says. "Nothing is more common for men, yea, and Christians, to clear themselves at the expense of others, and what is far worse, at the expense of the all-holy God himself. It perverts our view of the divine character. It deadens the sense of sin. It renders us blind and insensible to the only effectual remedy. It fosters pride, self-deception, and fatal delusion. It is pregnant with evils of incalculable magnitude and eternal duration. And let me say, the warning is as much needed now as ever. Men are as prone to err as they were in the apostles' day, and it is not one whit safer for them to do it at the present than it was in primitive times." So we have this tendency when life is hitting us, when life T-bones us, when life goes sideways, to ask questions and we start to wonder about God. Grant Osborne says it this way: "When we encounter trials of all stripes, we are faced with a choice by necessity. We can turn to self or we can turn to God." Church, we need to heed James's words here. Don't be deceived. Now, before we leave this first point, I want you to notice the tone that undergirds James's command. He refers to them for the first time in this letter as "my dear brothers and sisters," or "my beloved brothers and sisters." This endearing designation will surface two more times in this letter. And by addressing his friends in this way, James signifies the depth of his affection and concern for them and the strength of his connectedness with them, even though they are now separated geographically and scattered among the nations. Now, as I meditated on this verse, and especially upon this last phrase here, "my dear brothers and sisters," I began to ask myself, how often have I attempted to speak spiritual truth while lacking affection, concern, and connectedness with those to whom I am speaking? Or how often have I failed to be used by God to turn someone back to him because my well-intended, truth-filled presentation was communicated in a manner that did not firstly demonstrate my love for them, regardless of the immediate outcome? It's not easy to look in the mirror. I prefer not to look in the mirror. But if we truly desire to know the fullness of life that is ours as God's children, then we are going to have to allow his character traits to take root in our lives and to be manifest in and through us. There needs to be some love when we present things to people. Speak the truth in love, Paul writes. Let's move on to point number two. And point number two that we see in this passage is all good gifts come from God who does not change. All good gifts come from God who does not change. This, of course, is found in verse 17, which says, "Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. Now, most translations render the first phrase of this verse in a similar way to which it is found here in the New International Version, "Every good and perfect gift is from above." And when we read that in English, it seems like that there are two adjectives describing one word, gift. However, there are actually two different words being employed to describe the kind of giving that is taking place here. Many commentators believe that these two terms are simply to be regarded as synonyms, and that's why we get translations like the one we have before us. I think that James might be saying just a little bit more here. Here's a literal translation of this phrase, the first phrase here. It says, "All good giving and every perfect gift is from above." All good giving and every perfect gift is from above. Now, based on this literal rendering, it's justifiable to conclude that James desires his readers to know that every action of God's giving is good, and the result of God's giving is then complete or perfect. In other words, James is telling us that in spite of the appearances at times, all of God's giving is good, and everything that he gives us is perfectly suited to us and our needs. All God's giving is good, and everything he gives us is perfectly suited to us and to our needs. Look at the next phrase. It says, "coming down from the Father of heavenly lights." This word, the words translated here, "coming down," are suggestive of the fact that God's gifts, or God's good giving and his perfect gifts, flow forth to us in a continual and constant stream. Again, this is a practical faith way of looking at things. When we view things from our natural eyes, it may seem that the things that are happening to us and what we are receiving are anything but good and perfect. And the truth of the matter is, things may not change right away. But in those moments when life is shouting at us at the top of its lungs, practical faith whispers in our ears and reminds us that of these truths that we've been learning all along. Let me remind you what James has been telling us in his letter so far. He says, trials produce perseverance, leading to maturity and completeness, to a life of not lacking anything. He's told us that we can ask for wisdom to help us face our trials, and that everyone goes through trials. The last time we looked at this, he told us that God is the source of life. And then what we've looked at today, all of God's giving is good, and everything he gives us is perfectly suited to us and our needs. This is what practical faith tells us. And since all of this is from above, our implied responsibility then is to keep our eyes looking up and focused on God, the Father of heavenly lights. Now I'm going to quickly move on to the final phrase here in verse 16, which says, "who does not change like shifting shadows." What does James mean by this description? Well, this is obviously an allusion contrasting God with his creation, specifically with the heavenly lights that he has created, the sun, moon, and stars. I think I've mentioned this before, but if I haven't, I have a fascination with looking at the stars at night. I love it when there's a clear night. We've had clear nights a couple of days here now, and can look up and I can gaze at the wonder and the beauty of the countless stars. And I'm able to, and I'm just talking about the ones that I'm able to see with my unaided eyes. Countless stars up there. And I know there are so many more beyond that that I cannot see. And to think that God put every one of them just where he wanted them. And that he knows every one of them by name. Even the ones we have not discovered yet. I can look up and I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going to see Orion and where I'm going to see the Big Dipper based on where I saw them the night before. There is this constancy and predictability about them that I can depend on and I look forward to with great delight. And yet, it is my understanding that things are not really as they appear to be. The light that I'm witnessing at any given moment is not the light that is. Rather, it is the light that was. Many of the lights that I see have traveled thousands of light years. And for all I know, those stars no longer exist. The constellations I count on never remain in the same place for very long. Everything in creation is in constant motion. And James is saying here, over against all of this, which seems to be so stable, until we stop to really observe, until we take the time to really think about it, over against all of this is God, who does not change like shifting shadows. I love this description of God that Albert Barnes gives in his Notes on the New Testament. He says, he is always the same at all seasons of the year and in all ages. There is no change in his character, his mode of being, his purposes and plans. What he was millions of ages before the worlds were made, he is now. What he is now, he will be countless millions of ages hence. We may be sure that whatever changes there may be in human affairs, whatever reverses we may undergo, whatever oceans we may cross, or whatever mountains we may climb, or in whatever worlds we may hereafter take up our abode, God is the same. God is the same. Point number three is that God's preeminent gift is new birth through the gospel message. God's preeminent gift is new birth through the gospel message. While it is true that all of God's giving is good and all of his gifts are perfect, his very best gift to us is new birth through the gospel message. I want to ask you to do something. I want everyone to close your eyes. Here, don't worry, no trick's going to take place here, all right? Just close your eyes, and I want you to listen as I read verse 18. Let it sink in. It says, he chose to give us new birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all that he created. God chose to give us new birth through the word of truth that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. You can open your eyes now. I'm going to quickly talk about the origin, the agency, and the design of God's gift of new birth, which he has given to all who believe. James tells us that the gift of new birth finds its origin in God's choice or in God's will. This participle here, translated God's choice, he chose us, describing God's act of choosing, emphasizes that he freely decided to offer this gift to us without any kind of constraint or coercion. That is to say, God didn't need to save any. It was merely the good pleasure of God that he chose to do it. Let this glorious thought sink in. God delights in choosing you and me and all who will to receive his gift of new life through faith in his son Jesus, with the result that we become his sons and daughters. Let that sink deep in you. God didn't have to, but he does. I want you to notice something else in this passage. Look at what it is that God births. What is it that God births in us compared to what our own desires conceive and give birth to, which we looked at last time? God births life in us. Our own desires give birth to sin, which eventually gives birth to death. Life versus death. James here is purposely drawing a sharp contrast between what we will ultimately accomplish if we go life on our own and what God offers us by his gracious choosing. Well, how do we receive this offer of new birth? James tells us that the agency through which God accomplishes this is the word of truth. What does he mean by the word of truth? Well, there are some differences of opinions as to what this means, but the clearest explanation seems to be that this is a reference to the gospel message. The simple gospel message is that God himself, in the person of Jesus, set aside his divine prerogatives, took on flesh, humbled himself to the fullest possible extent by dying on a cross to pay the penalty for our sins and for the sins of the whole world. And then he rose from the dead and ascended again to his rightful place in heaven. That is a simple description of the gospel. And it says that through the word of truth, that is, by believing the gospel message, God gives us new birth into new life. And then second half of verse 18 explains God's design in choosing to give us birth through the word of truth. Namely, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. Now, this is a twofold design. To the original recipients of this letter, James tells them that God intended that they might be a kind of first fruits. And this, of course, is a reference to things from the Old Testament. And this is, again, this is a group of Jewish believers here, so they are very familiar with this concept of first fruits. And so this simply means that they were to see themselves as the beginning of what God would ultimately bring about. So they are just the beginning. And this, of course, leads to the implied second part of God's design, and that is that the gospel message would extend beyond its Jewish origin to reach Gentiles, resulting in an abundant harvest to the farthest corners of the earth. So you guys are just the beginning, but there's so much more to come. This gospel is going to go forth and reach the ends of the earth. Began this morning by asking a question. Is God really good? Is God really good? Well, James, in these verses, has demonstrated that God does not change. And since God has always been good, guess what? He will always be good. It only stands to reason that God really is good now, even when all of life around us is in chaos and seems to be crashing in upon us. Practical faith clings tenaciously to the truth that God really is good. Or as Kent Hughes has put it, the goodness of God is the key to spiritual sanity. The goodness of God is the key to spiritual sanity. Well, maybe as you sit here this morning, you're not convinced. Maybe you're in the throes of such trying times right now that the possibility of the goodness of God is being eclipsed by these things. You may be honestly struggling with the question this morning, is God really good? And it's okay. I wish I could tell you that if you just simply keep saying over and over again to yourself, God is good, God is good, God is good, that it will make it true for you and that everything will instantly get better. But I don't believe that. And God does not want you to believe that. And I'll be honest with you, I don't have a simple answer to your problems this morning. I don't have an instant solution. But I want to tell you, this is what I do when I question the goodness of God. I look at the cross. When I question the goodness of God, I look at the cross. And when I look at the cross, I see in that abused and emaciated body a God who loves an undeserving wretch like me so much that he was willing to suffer and die for me, the innocent for the guilty, so that I might not have to suffer and die for all eternity. So I encourage you this morning, if you find yourself wondering today, is God really good? I encourage you, look at the cross, and you will find your answer.